here's what I plan to do today. I'm going to start with 35.75, then do a little bit of jumping around, probably just pick up the Senate Bill 249 since that's Dick's bill also, and then move to the property tax bills, 35.10, 25.65, and 246 and 248. So let's start with 35.75. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 35.75. Dick, what I'd like is if you could just, since we didn't get to do this last time, briefly go through the bill, what it does, and then we'll ask some of the industry people to come up and report on the project.
Okay. Basically, the current law was set in 1993 before Measure 50, and so the process that it follows is that forest land is assessed at 20% of its statutory value. Values are set in statute and then indexed over time. 20% of those values then for a year will go on the roll. And the remaining 80% is collected through a severance tax, which is 3.2% on the west side and 1.8% on the east side. Since Measure 50, you have the 3% limit on increasing assessed value applying only to the 20% of values. It in no way impacts the severance tax, and therefore the tax that's paid on 80% of the forest land value. What the bill does is address that problem for owners, for forest land, which is owned by owners who have at least 5,000 acres. Okay, so this is sort of a division line between industrial owners, really, and small forest land owners. What it does is to require, if you own over 5,000 acres, that the forest land be assessed under this provisions of this bill. And what that does is establish the value for 1995, or actually the first year of the bill, which would be 1998-99, by taking the approach that was followed in Measure 50, establishing the 97 value as 90% of the 1995 value, and then growing it forward at 3% per year. And then for properties that are assessed that way, they're now on the roll in a comparable fashion with other properties, 100% of the value. They're exempt from the severance taxes. And what the bill is in two parts. The first nine sections apply to Western Oregon. The second do exactly the same thing for Eastern Oregon. And there are provisions in there which seem a little bit redundant, but they sort of say, okay, if you're assessed under these provisions, you're exempt from the severance tax, and if you're not assessed under these provisions, you continue under the existing system. And so it does that two different ways to make sure it's clear.
Okay. And what is the principal difference between this and 3734 from last session?
I think the principal difference is that was an option, an election on the part of the landowner. It had nothing to do with the size of the holding of the particular owner, but they could make an election, a one-time election, to be taxed at 100% of the forest land value, and thereby be exempt from the privilege tax. So the main difference is this, as it's currently drafted, requires that all owners who have over 5,000 acres go under the new system.
Do we have a sign-up sheet? Anybody signed up on 3575? Probably Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkerson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Dick did a good job of outlining House Bill 3575 as introduced. What I'd like to do, I think, is to bring the committee up to date on discussions that are occurring, have occurred in the last couple of weeks about the bill and about possible ways of resolving some of the issues that are in the bill. I think the two most difficult issues for the committee and legislature to deal with in 3575 as introduced is A, the revenue impact it would have in the biennium that's going to begin July 1. And second, if you basically eliminate the privilege tax for large landowners and retain it for small landowners, you're left with a system that has high administrative costs and very little revenue coming in, and that causes some efficiency problems for the Department of Revenue. So those are the two kind of problematic areas with 3575 as introduced. To bring you up to date, about 10 days ago, the governor contacted OFIC, indicated that he was interested in trying to figure out a way to resolve this issue, which, as you know, has been festering for several years now. We were obviously delighted to get that overture, and he had some fairly specific suggestions for us. Number one is he is concerned with a potential revenue impact in the upcoming biennium, given how tight the budget is, and we can certainly appreciate that. So he suggested that a bill would probably need to not have a revenue impact in the upcoming biennium. So he talked about a two-year delay in implementation. And then he talked about a phase-in, phase-out process where the privilege tax would gradually be reduced and the land taxes would gradually be increased over a period not to exceed 5 years. He said that would be the limit, and left open the possibility that maybe that could be compressed somewhat. The other issue he brought up with us is land values. As you know, the values against which the 20% rate currently is assessed against are set in statute. They were established in 1993. There apparently is some question about the, we didn't really see this as an issue until we did some checking after we talked with the governor. There is some question about the accuracy of those values. General sense people have is that maybe at the high end, on the high site, the values might be too high. At the low end, they might be a little bit low. Why this is an issue for the governor, and we figured it out afterwards, is if currently you're only assessed against 20% of those values. If the system has changed so you're assessed against 100% of those values, then the value becomes that much more important to the landowner. And if the landowner believes the value is not right, it's too high, he's likely to appeal or file appeals, basically saying the real market value is less than that, and I want be assessed against the real market value. So it could create a burden on county assessors having to deal with an increased level of appeal. So that was the other issue the governor mentioned specifically. And then in our conversation, we talked about, you know, how to deal with a small owner program that would remain if there is a special program that remains for small landowners. Also, the other administrative issues the Department of Revenue has. And then the double taxation issue that this committee, the whole legislature, has already addressed through House Bill 2452, and the governor indicated that that could be part of this package, that he's willing to include that in this package. So after that meeting, there's been a number of very intense meetings with the Department of Revenue, with county assessors, with the Department of Forestry and others, trying to figure out a modification of this bill that will be acceptable to anybody, everybody. I think legislative council is working hard also. They hope to have a working draft of amendments done this afternoon, and then this group will reconvene to go over it, and whether or not we'll be at a point where we could continue this tomorrow morning, Mr. Chairman, I don't know, but it depends on how legislative council can act and what the sense is of where we are this afternoon. Anyway, what I've distributed is kind of an outline of the components that are under discussion, based primarily on the governor's direction to us. And there's about five or six things in here. Again, we would have a dividing line between those who own more than 5,000 acres and those who own less than 5,000 acres, as 3575 does as introduced. For larger landowners, the privilege taxes would be phased out over some period, and the amount of the land taxes that your property taxes are assessed against would be gradually increased. One of the things we've talked about is instead of having a going from 20 to 40 to 60 to 80, immediately go to 75% land values, and then pending the results of the study of whether those values are accurate or not, and over the next 2 years, once that's been resolved, go to 100% of land values before the privilege tax is phased out. That would be a more immediate benefit to local government. And as you know from the last hearing, the counties and special district associations benefit and support from this proposal and support the bill. So that would help quicker. It also could allow for a lower privilege tax rate during the phase down and possibly allow for a shorter time period to get to the final phase. For those owning, for the smaller landowners, initially, for some of them, would like to be under the same program that the larger landowners want, which is 100% ad valorem program. So the amendments that were being talked about would allow for that, allow them to make that choice if they wanted to. For those who didn't make the choice, they would continue under the current system where they pay on 20% of their land values and then pay the privilege tax at the current rate. Over the next 2 years, work would be done to see if there is a more efficient small owner deferral program that could be developed, that one that wouldn't have the high administrative costs that the current program has. The Department of Revenue has actually been working on that over this past interim. They've talked about a system that would be based on timber volume as opposed to timber values, which is easier to calculate. Frankly, there's some small landowners that would like to be where the large landowners want to go. There's some small landowners that like the current system. There's some that are in various places, and it's been difficult. But just for the record, it doesn't matter to us. If the smaller landowners can agree on one proposal and it's acceptable to you, that's fine. We don't, you know, we just hope that difficulty in reaching some conclusion on that doesn't hamper the larger objective here. And I think that's why the most prudent thing probably is to work on it again for another 2 years, leave the current system in place, and try to develop a more efficient system to bring back to the next session. And then at the end of the phase-in, phase-out period, everybody would go to 100% ad valorem tax system, except those small landowners who wanted to opt out of that. It makes sense to have an opt-out instead of an opt-in. Frankly, if you continue on a 20/80 system and you never harvest any trees, you're getting a windfall from the system. I mean, you're not paying your fair share of taxes. So folks who need that system for some reason and think it's important because of cash flow, et cetera, you know, would have the ability to make that election. Otherwise, they'd be paying the taxes the same way as everybody else. The land value issue that the governor mentioned, he suggested a study of the current values and whether they're correct or not cooperatively with all the parties to get together and do the economic analysis that you have to do to make those kind of determinations. If there's inability to agree, that the governor suggested an arbitration process would actually be a mediation process, and we don't think it's likely that'd be necessary, but we're certainly willing to accept that. Come back to the next legislation with recommendations on possible revisions to those land values. And again, the purpose would be to minimize or avoid appeals of forest land values that would clog up the assessor's workload. Now, there may be, in doing this, there may be some Measure 50 issues. The Department of Revenue has asked the Attorney General about that. Can you change values more than 3% a year, I guess, is the most simplest way of highlighting a potential Measure 50 problem. So we need to be mindful of that, and the attorneys are looking at that to see what's doable there. And the fourth item, I guess, is distribution. The current way privilege taxes are distributed is very complex and expensive for the Department of Revenue to administer. If we retain a residual system for small landowners that includes privilege taxes, the cost of distributing those that very smaller amount of money under the current system would be very high. So I think what the amendments will suggest is a simplified distribution system. Initially, and this is another way to maybe compress the phase down period, all of the privilege tax revenues from the large landowners who were converting to the 100% ad valorem system for that short period of time, all of those revenues would go to the general fund to compensate for the impact on the school budget. And then for those who stay with the 2080 system, if one is retained over time, a simplified distribution system would, instead of every district getting a couple dollars, it would just be divided between counties and schools. And again, these are the kinds of things that the Department of Revenue has some real concerns about. How are they going to be able to effectively and efficiently administer the system in the future? So these issues are primarily in response to the problems that they see in the future. And the final one has to do with stumpage valuation, which is a complex subject, but that's how privilege taxes are based on how much the value of the timber, and so there's a process to determine that value that is also under the current system complicated and expensive and wouldn't really need to be in the future if you're just dealing with the smaller landowners. The final item is the double taxation issue that House Bill 2452 addressed. Again, the governor indicated he'd be willing to include that in this package. Representative Kefouri has some bill draft that's been prepared to get at that issue in a slightly different way than House Bill 2452 did. And if that is part of this whole package, the method of getting there that Representative Kefouri has suggested would be fine with us. So that's kind of a report, I guess, Mr. Chairman, on where we are in discussions with various people. And again, we're very pleased that the governor's indicated a desire to resolve this issue, and we hope we can get there before we get done with the session.
Yes, thank you, Ray. That's a very positive report and very encouraging developments because, as you say, this issue has been with us for a number of years, and unfortunately, it always seems to come up at this point in the session, this last minute, but I know that you and the other industry folks have been working very hard over the weekend, working with the governor. I just heard from council this morning that the volume and the complexity of the amendments might push this out to the first of next week, and that's really pushing up the limit. So I know that that's something everybody's working toward. But I think this is very encouraging news. I'm glad to see the governor involved in the process as well, since his signature is essential to make sure that this passes.
Right.
Mr. Chair. Okay,
well, yeah, I guess I want to, for the record, express my thanks to the governor's office. This, I think, is a fulfillment of a commitment that he made to me personally after the veto of 2452, that he would be looking at this and trying to bring to resolution some of the issues that were raised in that bill. And I'm pleased to see that it looks like we may be moving that direction and then even going beyond just the specific issues in 2452 and getting at these issues that are raised in 3575. So I want to go on record expressing my thanks there to the governor's office and also, I guess, to Mr. Wilkerson, Mr. Hanneman, and those folks who even after the painful experience of the veto, are still willing to deal in good faith with the governor's office and get this thing solved for the benefit of everybody involved. Glad to see you.
Absolutely. Other questions, comments? Mr. Merkley?
Mr. Chair, thank you. How will the bill handle recapture as people transition from the 20% tax into the 100% tax? And by recapture, I mean for folks who didn't harvest and therefore the privilege tax didn't offset the 20%.
Representative Merkley, I'm not sure I follow your question. The essence of the bill, 3575, and where we would get to through this more complicated glide path kind of proposal is that for forest landowners over 5,000 acres, at least all of them, and some or maybe most of smaller landowners, there would be, at the end of this period, however long it is, there would no longer be a privilege tax. And the forest land would be on the books at statutorily set values, and the tax rate would be assessed against 100% of those values, just like all other land is taxed in the state. And I'm not sure I was responsive to your question.
The question is this. If I'm a forest owner and I've been paying my 20%, and then I transition to the 100%, is there no way to recapture the what was the in lieu of
privilege
tax?
Representing Merkley, probably not, but I think the way to view the, and Dick can chime in here if I get it wrong, the way to view the 2080 system that was put in place in 1993 is to hypothetically consider all the forest land in the state as one unit and assume, as is correct, that the vast majority of those lands are managed on a sustained yield basis, which means there's a regular cycle and a certain percentage of the lands are harvested every year. So under that theory, which is reality as well as theory, the privilege tax brings in every year an incremental 1/50th of the deferred land taxes that are deferred for 50 years. So those who harvested last year, for instance, are paying more than what the deferral should have cost them because they didn't benefit from the entire 50-year deferral process. So it evens out, I guess. Is that responsive at all?
Yes, it is. Thank you. I think what you're saying is it evens out the industry as a whole. There might be individuals who delayed harvesting who would be in our...
Those folks would benefit. The folks that harvested between 1993 and now would pay the price to make it even out.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much, Ray.
Thank you.
I look forward to seeing the final amendment. Alice Probst.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Alice Probst. Address is 225 Southeast Walnut, Dallas, Oregon. I am a small woodland owner, and I'm also a member of Oregon Small Woodland Association. I am speaking in support of the bill, but considering the amendments that are in the process of being put together right now, and I would agree with Ray's testimony that has just been given. And Terry Lammers, the state issues coordinator, is unable to be here today, and he asked me if I would relay to the committee his a feeling about the bill, in support of the bill, but with consideration of the amendments that are under consideration. And they are meeting today, and that's why he's unable to be here this morning. And that's really all I have to say.
Okay. Yeah, he did send a letter to me explaining that as well, so I appreciate
it. Mr. Chair, I just want to know what's going on here. Ray Wilkinson is a constituent of mine. Terry Lammers is a constituent of mine. Alice Probst is a constituent of mine. And in fact, was my primary opponent in my first campaign. I think this is really unfair beginning.
He's touched the bill.
It's good to see Alice. Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don Schellenberg.
And so is Don Schellenberg. True.
Is there anyone in the audience who's not a good...
Mr. Chair, he's just not saying my district or in the state.
Mr. Chairman, I just know I want you to know I'm caring less and less about this bill every minute. Mr. Chairman, Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau, as well as a constituent of the Senate, I really appreciate that. And for Representative Williams' concern, I'll be very short then. Just want to climb on the bandwagon with this issue and just say that it is important to agriculture. Of course, 2452 being the most important part of that issue for farmers and ranchers. And with that, I'll just say good bill should pass. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Don. Anyone else here to speak on House Bill 3575? Okay. Seeing no one, we'll get back to this bill when we get further agreement and more amendments. Thank you, Dick. Did you have anything to add?
No.
Okay. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3575 and revise my schedule just a little bit because we do have some out-of-town folks here to testify, so I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2625. Okay. 2625 is comes from your committee, Representative Welsh. Do you want to tell us what it is?
Yeah, we'll bring up opponents here. But what we had tried to do here is to what was suggested we do. 2625 is to move square footage allowed in EFU
in processing facilities from 10,000 square feet to 40. And there were some on our committee and that would like to move that even to a higher number. But we stayed with 40,000 square feet and be able to allow that. The counties came in, said that the land values that would be assessed, you know, you have property just, if it was to be just bare property for farm use only, that there is not a lot of assessed value there for the county compared to a commercial or food processing facility. And that difference is what I was told it would mean something to the county. Well, when we start looking at this, and it's closer and closer, I decide, well, we'll just send it to revenue and let them do a quick revenue test on this and see if this really adds up. Well, as I read the revenue impact down here, it doesn't add up to a whole lot, but we will at least give the proponents of the bill a chance to talk about it just for a minute with us and see where the counties come in on this. I know that once you go from 10,000 to 40,000, 42,000 square feet is an acre of land. And so you can see, thinking about that and putting that in perspective, that we go from 10,000, which would be about a quarter of an acre, and move on up to an acre, there is certainly some lost value there. But how many of these facilities are going to expand? And reading the last paragraph near revenue impact, everybody thinks puts it into perspective. I don't, other than what the counties may correct me on here, I don't see it as being very significant, although it does allow some growth out there. But that's where it should be, for seed processing or for a winery, right out on the acreage that they're doing their business.
Okay, Carlos Chambers.
Good morning.
Hi.
My name is Carla Chambers. My address is 3122 Saulbush Island Road in Corvallis, Oregon. I am a farmer. I'm a vertically integrated farmer and food processor. And I wanted to give you a little history on this bill. This came out of a Senate Bill 588 set of documents we're passing around in the 1997 session. And as many of you know, farmers are under a great deal of strain nationwide and certainly in this state as well. This agriculture in this state will have significantly less net farm income this year than they did last year. And as with every industry in the nation that I'm aware of, massive restructuring is going on. And I guess at the heart of this bill, and this was true 2 years ago when we introduced Senate Bill 588, and it's true today, is really looking at ways to streamline and to really help farms change their structure so they can compete in an economic world that we live in today. And Representative Welch said that exactly right, is rather than exporting raw hazelnuts, we want to be exporting finished hazelnuts or finished peppermint oil or finished food products and really capture the value in Oregon rather than exporting such a high percentage of raw unfinished goods. Senate Bill 588 was really encouraged to was really intended to encourage value-added agriculture in Oregon by recognizing on-farm processing of farm products as an agricultural practice. This law affirms that the on-farm processing is a farm use under the land use laws and thus would affirm that the processing facilities would be subject to special use valuation and exemptions provided for agriculture under Oregon's tax laws. We, too, recognize that the revenue impact on local receipts appears to be very minimal. For example, one facility has been assessed as an industrial property for the first time in 97-98, yet the overall taxes decreased by almost $3,000. If the facility were taxed under farm use valuation, the personal property would be exempt and reduce taxes by only $380. With respect to the real property taxes, assuming a farm use valuation of approximately 67% of the real market value, the real property taxes would have actually been about $3,300 lower than the tax was actually charged. So the revenue impact of this bill is really insignificant in my opinion. The tax, however, and regulatory system of the state really needs to be consistent with public policy. The governor 2 years ago put together a food processors council specifically looking at our policies and ways to encourage more development of, say, the wine industry or more development of value-added food processing. The state's committed to a strong and invaluable policy of encouraging value-added agriculture. Value-added agriculture can transform Oregon from a state which exports its raw material wealth to a state exporting finished products and retaining and creating its wealth within the state. The additional wealth generated by Oregon's value-added enterprises in the state will be reflected in additional income tax revenues, fees, licenses, etc. I would point out to you that in the state of Washington, since 1997, there have been 6 new food processing facilities built. 3 of those have been on-farm food processing facilities. There's only been 1 in the state of Oregon in that time frame, and that belongs to my husband and myself. And there's real reasons why those are going up in the state of Washington rather than in the state of Oregon. In the last 2 years, Oregon has lost 2 of our top 10 food processors in this state to bankruptcy, and both of them have filed for bankruptcy in the last 6 months. And this area of incentive, in my opinion, is an area that we seriously need to address because it requires these types of facilities to really add value on a per-acre basis to really keep these farms competitive from other uses. And on-farm processing can make a significant contribution to that. The second part of what I've handed out is the different list of federal, state, and local agencies that regulate our business today. And I hope I didn't miss any, but my count is there are 34 federal, state, and local entities that regulate us as a farm and vertically integrated farm and food processing facility. At the heart, I think, of this legislation is the definition of agriculture. 2 years ago, in 1996, I chaired the Board of Agriculture. And just the Oregon Department of Agriculture was wrestling with what is the definition of agriculture. Now, I think that's important in this House Bill 2625, because we need to start being very clear about what agricultural entities are. Those of us that are small farms, it's very, very difficult for one entity to call us agriculture and then maybe another entity not to recognize us as agriculture. And this bill helps in a small way really, really address that. The second point I wanted to make, I provided you with a list of taxes, fees, and fines paid by those of us in Oregon agriculture. And that list is about 3 pages long. If we're not really attracting these entities to Oregon, you know, we may be looking here at the potential loss of real property tax or the potential loss of personal property tax. But what we're giving up is so significant in terms of adding value to our products or other overall taxes and fees that we would collect that the revenue impact of not encouraging this is far more insignificant than what we would recognize. And finally, in closing, if you would move to the last page, why move from 10,000 to 40,000 square feet? One, it really encourages these on-farm food processing facilities in Oregon and helps us to further vertically integrate and diversify Oregon's agricultural base. Secondly, this restructuring increases our per-acre return to agriculture, really helping to keep that land in agriculture. And with all the land use issues that are surfacing in this state, when you get right down to it, if the returns to agriculture are not great, we will see nothing but more pressure from other interests on that land. Third, it keeps the zoning for on-farm food processing under an agricultural definition. It's very difficult with 34 entities that regulate a business to come in and say, well, this 1,000 acres qualifies as agriculture, but this 1.2 acres doesn't. Agricultural equipment is exempt from personal property tax. And my last reason, I'd really encourage you to consider the environmental reasons for why these facilities make a lot of sense on farms. The DEQ gave our farm an award 2 or 3 years ago. We compost all of our solid waste. We irrigate all of our wastewater. We have a perfect natural environment for handling all the byproducts of these entities. And it really keeps semi-trucks and large trucks from going into downtown Eugene and large downtown facilities, and really keeps the dust and the noise and the wastewater out of these cities. So we're really encouraging the support of this legislation as it relates to helping farmers further develop their structures in this state.
Great. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? I have a question.
Is it true that you also are a constituent of Representative Shetterly?
I'm
Are you across the river?
I'm in Benton County, but I am across the river on Stallbush Island.
That's right.
I'm very close to his district.
Okay, then I can. Any other questions for the witness? Thank you very much. Jim, you have the witness list here. Do you want to call up the next witness?
On down to you, Vice Chair.
Tom Lynn here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Lynn here as Columbia County Assessor, representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I'm here today to speak in opposition to House Bill 2625. I think it really speaks to the difficulty of issues that have a land use as well as a property tax, farm use assessment bent. As you heard previously, this issue was brought up last session in Senate Bill 588 and again this session. This is the first time a revenue committee has dealt with either of the two bills. When the bill was introduced last session, it went to the Land Use Committee. We only discovered it late in the session. At that point, it was too late to get it referred to Revenue. We were told, in fact, we had serious discussions, arguments, debates with the Department of Land Conservation and Development whether the bill would actually affect farm use assessment. We were told that it would not. And, in fact, I think at one point, the AG for the DLCD and the AG for the Department of Revenue were actually arguing between themselves about whether or not it affected farm use assessment. As it turned out, the way the bill was written, it did affect farm use assessment. So properties that qualify to site a 10,000 square foot processing facility in an EFU zone did in fact qualify for farm use assessment. And that was a significant bill, 588, even though it was a minor bill, did not come to revenue, had a significant impact on the farm use special assessment statutes. Prior to that time, there was a very sharp dividing line between farming and processing. And there had been several court cases running back 20, 25, 30 years determining what is farming versus what is processing, with the clear distinction being farming is eligible for farm use assessment and processing is not. Senate Bill 588 jumped across that line, and at the time, our concern was that it opened the door, and once the door was open, it could never be closed, and more activities and sizes would want to enter, and House Bill 2625 is a good example. It increases from 10,000 to 40,000. We had heard earlier in the session that an amendment was actually being considered to raise the 40,000 to 75,000. So while the current 10,000 may be a small amount, affect very few properties, the 40,000 will pick up an additional number of properties that will qualify. And I guarantee you, next session, there'll be a bill to increase that 40,000 to something higher, 75 or 100,000. Right now, it's just small seed processors, maybe some small wineries. Eventually, it's going to include the big boys, the 200,000 square foot processors, where their basic focus is on processing, not farming. And I think this is going to have serious revenue impact. Obviously, the value of land under a commercial processing facility is a lot greater than the value of land under farm, because those values are only $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000, maybe as much as $1,000 an acre. The market value of a commercial processing facility may be as much as $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 an acre. So the revenue impact could be significant. Again, the distinction between a farm use bill and a land use bill gets us in trouble. This isn't the first time that somebody's introduced a bill to allow simply a use in a farm zone, and the way it's worded meant it automatically qualified for farm use assessment. We tried to fix that in our farm rewrite bill. It's too late for this one. So on behalf of the association, the door is open. I would ask that you not push it wide open and make it even easier down the road for more and more activities to qualify for farm use assessment that aren't strictly farming. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Gil Riddell, staff of the Association of Oregon Counties. Tom gave you a very comprehensive look at the policy issue here. I want to emphasize a couple of points. First of all, as you mentioned, this is the first time there's been a revenue review of this concept. This was dressed as a land use bill, and it just got away as that. This is the first revenue impact statement that's been made on this concept. We don't disagree with the ends trying to be achieved here. There's no disagreement with that at all. We're concerned about the means. As a policy matter under the property tax system, this is very dangerous. You define something as farm use and personal property processing equipment becomes exempt. I won't add anything to what Tom has said because he's been thorough. I would request, because we agree with this policy, or we agree with this, the ends that are trying to be achieved, that you explore maybe an income tax strategy or economic development grant strategy or something of that sort. But the implications of the property tax system are far greater than this particular issue.
Any questions? Sure. Say, William.
I guess my question would be that my understanding is we're talking about on-farm processing here. And, it sounds to me like if you talk about 200 to 300,000 square foot facilities, that seems rather unlikely to me. Obviously not initially contemplated in this bill, but I know this is kind of the slippery slope concern that you raised. But don't you think the fact that it's limited to on-farm processing is going to substantially limit the number of facilities that we're really talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, I can already see it in black and white, a bill to expand from on-site processing to a cooperative arrangement where a processing facility that processes products from a number of different farms on a cooperative basis would qualify. That would be a simple amendment to the statute to expand farm use assessment to that type of arrangement.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
But that's not the bill that's in front of us today. So you're looking into the future, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, we're looking at the door being thrown even wider open down the future, yes.
Well, I've got him on the stand, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask him, could you predict when the session is going to end for me, too?
Badgering the witness.
Mr. Chairman, may I make a small response, Representative Williams? We've seen over time that the farm, property tax, how the property tax system has worked with the agricultural processes leading up to processing, that has grown over time. It's taken some years, but it continues to grow. And there's nothing indicating that once you begin to grow it further, it won't stop. I mean, processing is, at this point, it's up to storage, right? From harvesting and then storage. So it's not unreasonable to assume that this won't you back to vex this committee over and over again.
Mr. Chair.
Were you through Representative Lynn?
For the moment, yes.
Okay, Representative Rasmussen.
More of a comment than it is a question, but it may be a function of term limits. In my short three terms, you do see little bills coming back a little bit larger every session. And, on the one hand, you can sit here and argue, well, this little bill is just this little bill, but be careful two terms from now when, I don't know how to convey how things grow over time.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to the good representative from Portland, I recognize that concern, obviously, but I think it's this committee's responsibility to view each bill on its merits as it comes before this committee. And if the concern is about the expansion of a policy growing a session now or two sessions from now, if I have the good fortune to be on this committee two sessions from now, I'll treat that issue as I cross that bridge.
Mr. Chair.
I think this conversation might better be held for a work session. If we have some questions,
I got
any questions. Okay, Welsh.
Okay. You come across pretty negatively against food processing and agriculture and what they can really add to this state as far as revenue and to counties. So what would you do to address this issue? How would you take this on? You've come in and you've just said that you don't like this, and we've been here before in past sessions. So really, what would be your resolution for this, and how can we add added value processing in this state? So important to keep that in agriculture and forestry, and everybody needing some property to build on. So what do we do here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Welsh, you raised, I think, the land use question, and Ron Eber is here to address that more specifically. Secondly, I would say the situation has changed after Measure 50, as you're well aware. Before, when these incremental changes to the farm use system occurred, there was an opportunity to pass the burden of property taxes to other taxpayers. We weren't faced with the stark issue of having to cut services to these lands and other lands by reductions in revenue. We were able to shift them to other taxpayers. The result of that process, however, brought us Measure 5, Measure 47, because the burden was so great on certain taxpayers. Just as a quick footnote to Representative Williams, you are seeing right now an incremental change from 10,000 to 40,000. So you're seeing it right now. This bill is an example right now of what you think will come in the future. My suggestion is, and ALC has been a strong supporter of economic development strategies which provide opportunities for value-added production. I think it's essential. We think it's essential as an organization. We just assume that you use your other tools available than the property tax system, which is now limited and on a rate base. We want to provide the sheriff's patrols to these areas and other benefits to these areas, and we need the resources to do that.
Other questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, isn't there a tremendous economic benefit to the state of Oregon for this processing to be done on site at the farm? Because otherwise, much of this crop is going to go out of state and can be processed out of state. And by expanding this size of the processing facility that would be subject to the lower tax rate, aren't we encouraging and providing a stronger incentive to keep those products, those crops, in Oregon so that they're processed here in Oregon, which provides economic benefit?
Chairman, Representative Witt, I think you make a strong case for some income tax or grant help. Keep in mind that when these facilities grow, the demand for services grows. And in the policy decision to use the property tax to have these processing facilities grow, you reduce the revenues available to provide services to these facilities, then I think you have more adequate tools to use than the property tax system.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just a follow-up on that. I think a part of the difference of view here might be the way we look at farming, or the essential functions of farming. small facility processing on site, to my mind, is part of the farming process. And I don't have a problem with expanding out. It's not just growing the crop, but where you can immediately process the crop and add some value to it. Isn't that a legitimate way of looking at the essential economic function of farming as it relates to these smaller type processing facilities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I can't disagree with you, particularly on a small scale. And we have never argued against activities that can be carried out in farm zones. What we're trying to do is make the distinction for the property tax break that is given. And again, there's been a sharp dividing line between farming and processing. Because once you get into processing, and under this bill, it's confined narrowly, although it is being expanded from the current use. But once you cross that line into processing, you have the potential for just continuing to include canning vegetables, canning fruit, things that are more properly considered commercial than farming.
Chairman, one other question.
Okay.
Do either of you know when this 10,000 square foot provision was put into the law?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, last session, Senate Bill 588, the land use bill did it, and it was not reviewed by the Revenue Committee.
Mr. Chairman, real quick. If I have a farm currently here in the Willamette Valley, I believe I'm able to put a larger processing facility on that as long as I pay essentially the property taxes based on commercial use. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, maybe you should ask Ron Eber from the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I don't think so, but I'm not a land use expert. That's why in Senate Bill 588, they added the language in two different statutes. One was 215.213, which speaks to what are allowed uses in a farm zone. And then 215.203 was the definition of farm use, where you picked up the fact that these facilities qualify for farm use special assessment. So because it's in 215.203, which is the uses allowed, I think only those uses, i.e. a 10,000 square foot processing facility, could be cited.
Mr. Chairman.
Under this bill, that would go up to 40. But if you're talking about citing a 100,000 square foot processing facility, the way I read the land use bill and under my limited land use expertise, I would have to say no, you could not cite that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, we're not the principal, the primary source for you on that question. Our land use expert tells me that it's a conditional use permit that's readily granted, but we leave that to Ron Ebert.
Yes, what I had been told previously that this wasn't about siting commercial facilities on a farm, and that, in fact, anyone who wishes to do so currently is granted such a permit. But this is really a tax case, and are we going to leave the land valued as farmland when commercial activity is taking place on it, and that essentially the 10,000-foot provision said for very small processing facilities, the answer in the current law is yes, we will leave the land valued as if it was being farmed. And I think there are two different tax issues. One is evaluation of the land, and one is evaluation of the building or equipment in the building. And maybe it's my understanding, and I'll state this so you can clarify whether this is correct, that the advantages between the two approaches are as follows. First, under the 10,000 square foot provision currently, and as it would be expanded to the 40,000 square foot provision, I'm not subject to the conditions, and those conditions essentially set up and ask, I have to show that I'm not going to affect activities on adjacent properties. So the first advantage is I'm exempt from my impact on my neighbors. The second impact is that the land is valued at a lower level. And the third impact is the equipment within the facility is not valued as personal equipment, so I have essentially one process break and two tax breaks. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that's essentially correct, yes. At least on the tax breaks side. I'm not sure about the land use side, but you're certainly correct. If the land gets a tax break, it gets effect lower, and the personal property, machinery, equipment would be exempt.
The piece of this puzzle that isn't clear to me is the actual building itself, since that is not equipment, and or is that defined as equipment for this purpose?
Chair, Representative Merkley, the building would be taxable.
Okay. The final question I have is, under the current law, only one quarter of the crop that needs to be processed in a 10,000 square foot facility needs to come from the farm itself. So essentially, I can have a facility that is three quarters commercial, that is processing other people's crops, and one quarter processing my own crop. Under this proposed expansion, would that one quarter ratio be preserved?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, yes, it would.
Thank you.
Representative Rasmussen.
Being a city girl, some of my questions may come out a little bit naive. I'm just trying to work my way through some concepts here. And if, for example, I decided I wanted to be a peppermint oil processor, and not particularly a farmer, but I located myself, it's one of a couple of things I'm doing. I'm located myself in one of the Halsey, and I have a small building going on there. Would I be eligible for this tax break, for this different valuation? I was located in Halsey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rasmussen, I think if the personal property is already exempt.
Okay.
Mint processors came in some time ago and got mint processing equipment specifically exempted.
Oh, okay.
And I'm a city boy myself. It's my understanding that mint processing is fairly small scale, and I'm probably going to get myself in trouble here.
With the building itself?
The building would be taxable. Buildings are always taxable.
Whether it's on the farm or the land would be the same value with on the farm or in the city?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rasmussen, buildings are always taxable.
Yes.
Sloth barns, hay storage sheds, milking parlors, they're all taxable.
Okay. So it would be that the land, I mean, if this, the passage of this bill, would my competitor that's out there on the farm have a different tax structure than I would here in the town, whether it's mint oil or sheep wool or whatever it is we're going here. If I was a processing facility, 10,000 square feet, I'm located inside the city limits of Halsey, and I have someone who is out on the farm, sitting on an exclusive farm use right, they are also processing on site. Would they have a tax advantage over me simply because they're out there on their farm with the passage of this bill?
Mr. Chair, as Rasmussen, assuming you weren't processing 25% of your own mint, the answer would be yes. If you were processing 25% of your mint,
well, let's
then even if you're inside the city limits, it would be eligible for farm use.
Let's take mint off the table then. What other product out there, that farming product, seed, whatever it is, that doesn't have its own special little exemption?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rasmussen, the expansion from 10,000 to 4,000 square feet, most of the activities that I've been told would pick up the benefit are small wineries.
Okay, so I'm a small winery in Halsey. Would I be taxed differently from someone out on the farm?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rasmussen, again, assuming you're processing your own grapes and you have a vineyard in town, that could qualify for farm use assessment. But it all depends on the situation.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Ron Eber. Chair Strobeck, members of the committee, my name is Ron Eber. I'm with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I'm the rural land specialist for the department. Spoke about this bill before Representative Welch's committee and was also involved in some of the development of these statutes in the last session, this Senate Bill 588. What I wanted to do was explain the relationship here between the land use and the tax impact and simply speak to the land use side, indicating that you've already heard the merits and the pros and cons of the tax effects of this bill. Our concern with the bill is that the manner in which that tax benefit is being provided has a significant effect on the land use side of the issue in terms of how processing facilities are sited in an exclusive farm use zone. As was pointed out to you, there are two ways now that you can get processing facilities in a farm zone. They're either these small, less than 10,000 square foot facilities, which are reviewed locally, or there are commercial activity in conjunction with farm use. Since the exclusive farm use statute was revised in 1973, that's when the language commercial activity in conjunction with farm use was put into the statute. It was written broadly. It was intended to cover the wide range of products and processing activities out there. It has worked very successfully. I am aware of only three court cases that have ever argued over whether something was a commercial activity in conjunction with farm use, and those activities have been routinely allowed in farm use zones throughout the state. And in fact, since 1994, I had some recent statistics, at least 65 new commercial activities in conjunction with farm use have been provided for in counties, ranging from seed cleaning, honey and corn syrup packaging, onion processing, apple cidery, cherry brinering, and the like. And actually, even since this bill came over from the Water and Environment Committee, I've received notice for three or four more commercial-type activities in several counties here in the Willamette Valley. So they move forward. Our view is there is not a land use problem with processing activities. Prior to the 1997 session, as part of this review on processing that Mrs. Chambers referred to, there was also a group convened by the governor to look at the land use side of the processing activity. We looked at that. We found no particular problems. However, it was decided that it would be beneficial to try and streamline the process, that the smaller on-farm type activities would not have to go through a full conditional use process. The commercial activities in conjunction with farm use that we have now have to be reviewed against the standards in 215-296. That is, that essentially they are looked at for off-site impact on surrounding farms and for interference. It was decided that the smaller on-site type activities would not need to go through that process because they were more localized. And there was also the decision to extend a tax incentive or tax break to those activities. That statute seems to have been working. Our concern is that when you increase that 10,000 square foot size to 40,000 and we go from a quarter acre structure to almost a full acre structure with the increase in processing activities and traffic, we believe that that is the size that requires the off-site review and impact under 215-296, and we don't support increasing that size. If the committee wants to extend tax incentives or breaks to ag processing, that's obviously your decision. The department is neutral, although we have always been in support of the farm deferral system as an incentive and encouragement to agriculture. We simply believe that the way it is being done by that increase in the square footage is the wrong way to do it and exempts larger scale operations in the farm zones from what we think is an appropriate land use review. So with that, I'll close and answer any questions that you have.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Eber. Mr. Merkley?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Eber, the standards you referred to in 215.296, which I refer to as the good neighbor provisions, one says that the practice will not force a significant change in accepted farm or forest practices on surrounding lands, and the second says will not significantly increase the cost of accepted farm or forest practices on surrounding lands. These sound like rather modest standards to meet. Am I missing something?
Here.
Chair Strobeck, Representative Merkley. I don't believe so. They are modest. They require a good faith look at whether the siting or the nature of the operation that's going in will interfere with surrounding farm operations. 215-296 also allows the counties to add any additional standards that they feel are appropriate in terms of off-site impacts or in the review of this type of large-scale operation.
Mr. Chair, have counties added provisions that were extremely unreasonable or onerous?
Chair Strobeck, Representative Merkley, I'm not aware of any. I know Mr. Schlack from AOC was here and works with the county planners. He may know of something. But like I said, since 1973, there have only been three court cases that I'm aware of, and most of those dealt with whether the specific activity being proposed really was related to farm use and was a commercial activity in conjunction with farm use, not over the type of conditions that had been imposed.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Could you respond in like 2 minutes or less?
I would just encourage the committee to look at a very proactive stance on this rather than a regressive stance. Our particular farm in 1990 had two crops, sugar beets for seed and wheat. And we competed against what was going on in the state of Pennsylvania and started growing pumpkin. And today our farm supplies all the pumpkin for Mrs. Smith's pies. And that has really been good for Oregon. The taxes we pay are significantly more. In 1998, our farm received a U.S. Presidential Award for our sustainable farming practices and for our environmental friendliness. And basically, we brought business to Oregon that was in another state. And that's really helped us add benefits and improve the quality of life for our employees. And it's really increased the overall tax base and economic development in Oregon and specifically in Benton County. So I would just encourage you to really recognize the restructuring that's going on in agriculture and really look at this in terms of what needs to be done to keep us competitive on a world front that we now compete in. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is anyone else here to speak on House Bill 2625? Seeing no one, as soon as we get the rest of the committee back, we'll go into a work session. So I'll close the public hearing on the 2625. Wait for a couple of moments. I just say where we're going to go next. We're going to go to... a little ironic, we're going to go to 248. We need to reconsider that and add in the amendments, right? And then we'll go to 246.
Which one is 248?
248 is a farm use assessment rewrite, and there's a conflict amendment that we need to adopt.
So it's a conflict bill?
It's a bill that creates the conflict.
Yeah, okay.
We'll stand at ease for a moment.
Thank you.
What is your else opinion? Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 2625.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I move House Bill 2625 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves House Bill 2625 to the floor with the due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Representative Merkley.
I'll be opposing this bill. I oppose it in Water and the Environment as well. The current good neighbor standards are extremely important when processing facilities are established. They're very reasonable standards. They simply ask, before you put a larger processing facility in, that you look upon at the impact upon neighboring farms. This bill eliminates those good neighbor practices on processing facilities up to an acre in size, recognize that these are not simply processing food that is on the farm, but food, three-quarters of the food, of three-quarters of the input to the processing coming from other farms. So it really starts to look a lot like a commercial facility. There is an issue of fairness between commercial facilities that pay their tax on their equipment and pay their tax on their land, and those that through this loophole will not be doing so. And I think so both in the, because of the good neighbor provisions and because of the fairness between processors, this is not good legislation.
Okay, thank you. Other comments?
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, what?
I'd just make the point that, you know, we provide tax breaks through the Strategic Enterprise Investment Program to large high-tech companies. We provide tax breaks on economic enterprise zone activities. This one-quarter, three-quarter, which is the minimal requirement that one-quarter would come from the farm, has been in statute, you know, since 1997. I think this is a logical expansion, and it recognizes that from an economic standpoint, it's good for the state of Oregon to keep these processing activities close to the farm, in these cases on the farmland, and I think it's a logical extension of the policy we've had, so I'm happy to support it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I will be opposing the bill, but not out of a sense of opposing agriculture. I'd like to suggest to the, as we start to plan for the Interim Revenue Committee's work, that we might spend some serious time reviewing farm taxation and the number of, how it has evolved over the last decade, and maybe some recommendations of how we should be taxing farms in the future. I would strongly recommend that to the Interim Revenue's attention, that we're probably at a place where, now that we have a nice cleaned up statute, organized statute on farm taxation, we might want to take a step back and see if that is, if it is a tax policy that is doing what we want to have happen for Oregon farms.
Any other comments? I just say I will support moving the bill. I'm not absolutely certain I'll vote for it on the floor. But as far as the concern of this committee in terms of the revenue impact, I think that's minimal. I still have some doubts, I guess, in my own mind about the land use portions of that, so I'll look at the bill again.
Chairman Corbett, just,
yeah.
I know I didn't really talk about the revenue impact, but I just want to make sure that, you know, you're all clear with what I've written here. When I was first analyzing this, I was given the interpretation that this was something that was only going to be affecting the land of the facilities, and now everyone's saying that the personal property is completely exempt. So, you know, obviously this revenue impact is much larger than what I've written here, and I will revise it when it actually goes to the floor. But this is something that the personal property is clearly a lot larger in value than any of the land changes here. So, you know, all you're really looking at when I did the small estimate is just the change of the land being at farm use assessment versus industrial or commercial use. So, you know, there's no doubt that this, you know, you don't really have a good sense. You know that there's a few wineries, you know that there's a few seed cleaning warehouses, but, you know, it's not clear, you know, that personal property of those various facilities will be significantly more than any of the land value. And that's one comment I got from a couple of counties that I did talk to, is they weren't concerned if they were only, so it was only going to be given a special assessment on the land of the facilities, but they were concerned if you were going to be incorporating the personal property of those processing plants being exempt. So, and at this point, I don't have that information. I just didn't have time to get, I got a sense from a few counties, and the Department of Revenue staff did a little bit of a survey of counties as far as, you know, how many additional processing facilities they thought would come underneath this 40,000 square foot. But as far as, you know, them getting any numbers, as far as the value of that personal property, we don't have that information yet. I just want to make sure that's clear to everyone. What I've given you is just an estimate of how much, you know, a particular facility might get as far as a tax benefit of just their land, but their personal property can be significantly larger.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Sherman?
I was gone for part of the time. We did not hear from Farm Bureau on this.
They did not. They didn't speak here.
Where they stand on the policy. I'm a little concerned from Elizabeth's last comments about what seems to be an unknown now, I guess, in terms of the revenue impact of this. You know, I've got in my district probably as many of these facilities potentially as we could see anywhere else in the state under this bill, and so I want to be cognizant of that on behalf of my constituents, even though most of them seem to have left now. but I also want to be responsible on the revenue impact. So I'm having a little problem here as we find out that we may be taking action on this without a full understanding of the revenue impact. And if the chair's inclination is to move forward with this, I guess we would always take a look at the revenue impact before it gets to the floor, but I hate to pass things out without that early, especially since it was sent here, Ryan, as far as I understand, to get a sense of what the revenue impact is going to be.
Okay, any more comments, discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, I originally was prepared to vote for the bill based on the revenue impact looking pretty minimal. But is it possible that we could get a revised revenue impact without delaying this too much, given that we've got hearings the next couple of days? How long would it take to come back?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Representative Rosenbaum, is it scheduled tomorrow?
No, it's not.
Oh, okay.
Is it? Oh, it is?
It is, yeah. Well, I mean, I could share survey, and I'm sure the Department of Revenue staff could help me, too, as far as gain a few counties and then some of that value. So I would think by tomorrow we could at least have some better estimates.
Mr. Chair, it would certainly make me more comfortable voting for the bill if we could see those figures before we send it out. I understand we're under some time constraints.
Well, since the bill is posted tomorrow, that would be not an excessive delay, perhaps. I assume you would also, if you're talking about the exemptions for processing of personal property, that you would include then the values, as Mr. Linhare said, buildings are always taxable. That's something we'll all remember.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you would include those as in a positive?
Yeah, that isn't a change in current law.
Okay.
The only change is just allowing these additional facilities that are between 10,000 and 40,000 square feet.
Mr. Chairman.
So you're only talking about the personal property processing material. Aren't those already taxed again?
No.
They are taxable.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative West.
The problem with the revenue forecast, Mr. Chairman, I think you just said it, is that since these facilities will be at a lower assessed value, and the personal property could be exempt, what we're doing is we're encouraging more of these buildings to be built on farmland, and I wonder if the revenue impact is going to take into effect the fact that we will have more buildings being taxed. My concern is we're going to get a one-way revenue forecast here. We're going to show a decline in taxable revenue. We're not going to show the likely increase in taxable revenue for more of these facilities being built and being taxed on farms.
I would say it's representative, but all I will be capturing is just when I survey counties to say, you know, do you know of any particular processing facilities that would fit that already currently exist? That already currently, you know, have the buildings in place that are being taxed? You know, would they qualify under this 10,000 being increased to 40,000 square feet?
Representative Wood, I'd recommend that you withdraw your motion. We'll just bring this up for work session tomorrow. Have the piece of paper in front of us.
I withdraw my motion.
Okay. We'll see you tomorrow. We'll close the work session until 26:25. Thank you all. We'll look for that tomorrow. Now open a work session on Senate Bill 248. And the chair moves to suspend the rules to reconsider Senate Bill 248, to reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 248. Is there any objection? So ordered. What we need to do is, Elizabeth, can you tell us what we need to do on this?
Yeah, what you have before you is a -A5, and what this is incorporating some conflict that needs to be resolved in it with another bill. So it's the exact same -A4 that we passed out, only with the additional changes that Legislative Council found in order to need to resolve the conflict.
Okay. Chair moves adoption of the -A5 amendments in Senate Bill 248. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair moves Senate Bill 248 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chair, I'm just catching up with you here.
Do you know that folder open?
There's trees, I think.
This is the rewrite of the farm use assessment statutes that we passed out sometime last week. We had some conflict amendments that did not get included. It simply is resolving this bill with other bills. So that's what we need to do. We need to reconsider that, stick these in, and pass it. Any objection? So ordered, bill returns to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Same carrier, whoever that might have been. Now we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 246. Mr. Maneri?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Maneri with the Department of Revenue. I do have a summary on Senate Bill 246. Fundamentally, what 246 covers is three topics. In sections 1 and 2, this is a follow-up from implementation on Measure 50. This involves omitted property corrections. So this would be the assessor discovers that some property wasn't included on the roll for an earlier year and now is going to go back and put the property on the roll. This particular provision clarifies when you do that, how you do a Measure 50 limit calculation for the property, and basically clarifies that you do it the way that you did all other property on the roll at that time. So that was the only clarity we needed, was how you do the limit calculation for that property when you're going to go put it on the roll for an earlier year. Section 3 is our proposed policy change as to the disqualification of exempt property. Occasionally what will happen is that someone, a charitable or other organization, will go to the assessor and apply for an exemption. The assessor will grant the exemption, and that property will then be receiving it. And at a later time, an assessor determines that it is no longer that it does not qualify for the exemption. That can be a change in judgment. It can be a number of things. Under current law, when that is done, it is subject to rollback taxes, basically, up to 5 years. If it had been receiving the exemption for up to 5 years, then they have to pay back taxes on it when it's disqualified. We're proposing that we don't think it's good policy that the government reviews the property and grants an exemption and continues the exemption, and then later the decision is changed, and then they have to pay taxes in a case where the government had reviewed it in the first place and said it was entitled. So what we're doing here in the bill is saying at the time when you discover that it really doesn't qualify for an exemption, that you would disqualify it prospectively and that they wouldn't have to pay back taxes. The exception in here is if the taxpayer fails to notify the assessor of a change in use. So obviously, if they were granted exemption under a particular use, and then they change the use of the property that no longer qualifies, that you could go back in that instance where the assessor wasn't aware of it.
Under what other circumstances would you decide that it wasn't eligible for a special rate anymore, special tax treatment, I mean, other than a change in use?
Mr. Chair, sometimes an assessor will review properties, a normal review, and say, we really don't think you should have been getting an exemption all along. It's not charitable. It's not, it's basically just a re-review that happens to be done, and now that assessor determines that I don't think he should have been qualified all along, although either that assessor or an earlier assessor had granted the exemption. I mean, it can happen in any circumstance for a property. Sometimes these statutes, by the way, are difficult calls. The rules on charitable and some of the other exemptions, it's a factual judgment on whether it really qualifies. So we're looking at where it's been granted in one instance, and then a review determines that it concludes that it probably shouldn't have qualified.
Okay, well, I think this happened in Lane County. Jim worked with me at last session on there was an exemption that was changed. A charitable or an organization, which happened to be the One in Junction City, which is the Scandinavian Days Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular group, you know, was had a building, and they used it in the city. City all used it, and in the city, they were viewed as being more like a chamber of commerce, which they really weren't. But what they had, well, it was a cross, kind of a crossbreed, I guess. And so, but they viewed that exemption as not allowable, and then they were assessed back taxes on that particular building. The whole city benefited by the building, and it was, in my view, charitable. And I agree. This, as they continue to review these and change them, it can be quite a hit on certain organizations that do benefit communities. So I think this, as I read it, could be a real benefit even for our small community.
Mr. Chair, then Section 4 is a clarification in terms of limited property. It's how property is reported at the county and the state level. For personal property, there's a personal property return. For real property, there's a real property return. That's covered under the law currently. What isn't covered is the department's industrial program. We've combined the returns so that the taxpayer can report on one return. So we're clarifying that it also, the law applies to those returns. And that covers the bill.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Anybody else to speak on Senate Bill 246? Okay, I'll close the public hearing, open the work session. Senate Bill 246, Sheriff Jane Rasmussen.
Move Senate Bill 246 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Rasmussen moves Senate Bill 246 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who would like to carry the bill?
Representative Welch spoke so eloquently.
Yeah.
Oh, he carried a lot of bills. Is that good? Why don't you carry the bill?
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
My question is ready.
Work session is closed. Paul, I guess we'll go ahead and do it. We've got a couple of minutes. So, never mind. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 249 and ask Mr. Browning and Mr. Cooper from the lottery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm with the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Browning with the Department of Revenue. Senate Bill 249 is a very simple bill, and we'll make it very quick, just an overview, and please ask questions as we go along. It looks very extensive, but basically what it is it's a cleanup of the old amusement device tax program. The amusement device tax program is an old program, and the statutes were never changed. The wording is awkward. The way it works is awkward. It was changed several sessions back to restrict it now just to video display terminals. That's the only device that actually pays this tax anymore. It used to be on pinball machines, arcade machines, sometimes with little horse and boat rides you see outside Safeway. That's all gone away. All we have now are the video display terminals. And the Department of Revenue and the Oregon Lottery kind of co-administer this program, I guess you would say. Senate Bill 249 is a cleanup bill. There are no policy changes in it. I've handed out a summary that shows you section by section. I'm just going to get a couple of them for you so you have an idea what's in there. It does remove obsolete language that's related to devices that aren't subject to the tax anymore. It cleans up the language that's in the statute right now, and it does revise some of the due dates to make the program work a little more effectively. In Section 1, the only one I would touch upon is Sub 1, the definition of amusement devices, where you can see the change to delete the things like pinball and arcade machines and that type of thing from the definition. And then Sub 6 also talks about the tax year. It begins July 1st and ends June 30th. Section 2 just has more clarifications in there. Talks about the tax is $125. And again, that hasn't changed. Sub 3 clarifies that the tax will be prorated if you don't use your device during the whole, don't have your device in place, your lottery terminal during the whole year. Section 3, no changes, really. Section 4, really no changes. Section 5, subsections 1 through 3, that's just trying to pull together some of the collection of fee provisions that have been scattered through this. The intent of Senate Bill 249 is really to give a clean statute so that lottery, Department of Revenue, and the video terminal operators will have a place to go and really review the statute and see what they're supposed to do. As it is now, it's almost unworkable. It's just kind of scattered everywhere. So it's sort of similar to the Farm Bill, Senate Bill 248, trying to pull it together on a very small program. Sub 5 on Section 5 clarifies that the tax is paid in advance and it will not be refunded under any circumstances. And that's consistent with the way the program is administered now, too. So it's an annual fee, annual tax, and it's not refunded. It is prorated if you don't have your device in place, as I mentioned, for the whole period of time. Section 6 talks about the $200 failure to pay penalty, and the department can also waive the penalty if failure to pay is due to lottery division's failure to transfer funds to the department. Section 7, really not much of a change. Section 8 just clarifies that the lottery and its staff aren't agents of the Department of Revenue when enforcing this program. 9 and 10 and 11, really nothing substantive there. Section 12 repeals some statutes that are now obsolete that talk about temporary permits. Department of the lottery, state Oregon State Lottery does not issue temporary permits for video display terminals. And then Section 13 just basically states that the changes in Senate Bill 249 won't affect assessments that are out currently. So that's basically all there is in Senate Bill 249. It's a method for cleaning up the statute and eliminating some old provisions from a very old program that's basically been scaled way down now, the video display terminal. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. I also have David Hooper from the Oregon State Lottery here, too, as well. The two agencies have worked real closely on this, and our legal counsel drafted this jointly, so we're confident it works well.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, thank you for coming over. Anybody else like to speak on this bill? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 249. Dick, you have anything to add?
No.
In the work session on Senate Bill 249.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
Move Senate Bill 249 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Rasmussen moves Senate Bill 249 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Move to the floor. Representative Rosenbaum, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure. I'm going to take it.
Oh, boy.
That was very amusing.
Oh,
I got it out of my system.
Been hanging out so much with Representative Shetter.
Uh-huh. Okay, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 249. Tomorrow we'll deal again with the 2625 and whatever else is on the agenda. 3575 is on the agenda again tomorrow. I'm not sure that there's going to be much new that will develop over the day. So, we're adjourned.
Did you go in with 3575?
No.